Hello and welcome to Dealcast, the M&A podcast from Merger Market. I'm Julianna Needham. Today we're considering the tale of two very different markets here in Europe. M&A, which has seen strong deal activity, first quarter European deal volume hit around 332 billion euros, close to a 40% increase year on year, all fueled by a rush of mega deals as corporates chase scale, resilience, and a strategic advantage. But on the other side, there are the equity capital markets. Despite the stars seemingly aligned at the start of the year for a good year, they're struggling to get going. With IPO activity limited, there are timetables slipping, and recent listings have delivered disappointing aftermarket performance. So what explains this difference? Why is Europe confident enough to do big M&A, but not bullish enough to list companies? Are M&A and ECM now operating in parallel worlds, or are they responding differently to the same challenges? Well, to find out, John West, Merger Markets Global Commentary Editor, sat down with Sam Kerr, the head of global ECM, to find out.
So yeah, slightly parallel worlds in terms of what's going on at the moment between M&A and IPOs, or at least it feels like it. I think it's probably a bit more complicated under the hood. We look at M&A in the first quarter, right? That's up 38% in volume terms, up like 330 billion euros. And that matches a stock market run that, despite, you know, everything, has been remarkable. You know, obviously, since the Iran war, we did see a dip in the stock market. We saw some retrenchment of those prices, but they came storming back in the last couple of weeks as hopes, maybe more than expectations, of some sort of deal have materialized. Those headline numbers for IPOs, though, are nowhere near so healthy.
No, and actually, I think what's worth pointing out is we have equity capital markets, we have IPOs, and we have European IPOs. And it's right. Sort of three very different sort of pictures. General equity capital markets, I would say, are pretty healthy, even in Europe, which has been a bit of the laggard in the IPO market.
Yeah.
You know, you can do some tremendous deals in equity capital markets. You know, the M&A financing we
saw
with,
this is it.
Yeah, Zurich and Beazley, right?
Yeah.
You know, perfect that. And you know, the block trades we're seeing. So anything in listed stock, where you've got an already listed business, you can model it very easily. There, or you know, you're doing an M&A transaction, and there's a lot of rationale behind what's happening.
Yeah,
you know, you can do pretty much, you know, whatever you want. There's some massive transactions,
or where there's consensus on the valuation.
Absolutely,
if you look at the EQT-led exit out of Galderma,
that was
huge. The last trade was upsized.
Yeah, 6 billion around there, and it was phenomenal transaction. And actually, the interesting thing is EQT, from our understanding, didn't plan on doing that when they first came out.
Right,
and they
right.
were going to do it over sort of a couple of deals. The demand was there to do it, and they thought they'd do other shareholders in Galderma a bit of a favor, remove the overhang, obviously, as well, uncertainty around the war. It was done right at the beginning of the conflict.
Yeah.
So they got the deal done. They got the full exit completed. And it really showed you what you can do in this market.
Yeah.
And actually, you can be very ambitious, as long as you're not trying to do a new European listing.
Well, this is it. You mentioned there Zurich Beazley, and obviously Zurich managed to print quite a large check via equity capital markets in order to finance that deal. That deal is obviously all about building scale. Scale continues to be the driving force of M&A. But under the hood, and we'll come to the European IPO market in a moment, under the hood, that scale play is hiding quite a lot of pain.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you look at March, March alone, because obviously the bomb started landing, I think, on February the 27th, right?
Well, February 28th. Yeah, February 28th. It was a sort of Friday night, famously a Friday night, because there was a French block trade that night. It was very, very odd to see a block trade on a Friday night. So I think they possibly were potentially seeing some conflict coming down the line.
The troop movements and that. Yeah. But on the 28th, the bomb started falling. Yeah. So you have March. March is a clear month affected by Iran. If you look at the European M&A of 1 billion euros plus, that was up more than 90% in volume terms.
Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah.
But if you look at the M&A below 1 billion, down 25% year on year.
Yeah.
It's very clear that there's a different story to be told in the mid-market versus the mega caps and yeah. the chase for scale. I've joked, right?
That yeah.
The easiest way to build scale, if you're McCormick buying Unilever Foods, if you're UniCredit aiming to get Commerzbank, if you're Poste Italiane trying to get Telecom Italia, the easiest way to get scale is to start off pretty big in the first
100%.
Place. Yeah. But under the hood, there's quite a deal of pain, isn't there?
Well, I mean, that's interesting. And actually, that's absolutely been reflected in ECN as well. So, you know, March was, in volume terms, one of the best months we've had for European ECM in many, many years. In fact, I think it was the best month since the start of 2022 in true volume terms. That came across like 4 mega deals. And so that's exactly the same thing as happening.
That's
here.
It.
You know, it's the big scale transactions that are getting done, the large caps and you know, these mega cap transactions, very popular among investors. People are willing to back them. Anything sort of even smelling a bit mid-cap, and suddenly you get into a far more difficult scenario.
Yeah. And actually, if you look at the first quarter, the exits from sponsors, and I think this is a big, you know, this ties in with the IPO weakness that we've seen
absolutely.
As well. The exits from sponsors below 500 million euros, down 21% year on year. And I think there's two reasons for that. The first is, a lot of those private equity investments are software related.
Yeah.
And we all know about the impact of the Claude Code Cowork plugin from Anthropic and the impact they've had on the SaaS players. And, you know, private equity is heavily invested in that. But also, 2026 was always meant to be crunch time for delivering DPI on that crop of investments from 2020, 2021, really toppy. We haven't seen the multiples rise. In fact, we've had multiple compression.
Yeah.
And they've, you know, a lot of sponsors have marked those assets to market very aggressively.
Yeah.
And they're not seeing the exit route. Now, it was interesting because before we were recording, you were saying that actually really good equity markets, you would think really great for sponsor exits.
Yeah.
But there's a problem, especially if there's been multiple compression.
And this is it. Really good equity markets like we're seeing at the moment. And as we're recording, US markets are back at
record
highs, despite what's going on in the Middle East. That problem is the peers that these companies are being marketed against are now pretty much back to their top valuations.
Yes.
Now, that bull run we've seen in the United States and also assumingly in Europe feels very technical in nature. You know, there was a lot of options issues coming around this month. Options expiries, very expensive options.
At the turn of the quarter.
At the turn of the quarter, right. So very difficult to hedge. So a lot of short squeezing, which accentuated a rally into a real bull run where it might have just been a tiny bit.
And that brings a lot of retail in, right? Because they're all buying the dips.
Yeah, can we buy the dips and at the top of the market. Now, that means fundamental investors, long only as your typical IPO market investors, are looking at the market thinking it's far too expensive. They're looking at peers thinking they're far too highly valued potentially and will drop. That means their discounts that they're going to be asking for the IPOs are going to be even greater to the peers than the sponsors are going to want to pay.
Yeah.
So we'll get to a situation here where there's issues like TK Elevators, for example,
right. You
know, one of the big IPOs that was expected this year.
Correct.
Now, obviously, there's a lot of talk now that that might be going to Kone in a strategic M&A transaction.
Yeah.
Now, if you look at the rationale behind that, you know, they bought the thing for just over 17 billion euros EV, as Simban and Advent being the sponsors. And, you know, at current peer valuations with the multiple compression we've seen even from the peers, you're looking low 20s EV, like 23, 24 times. Now, that doesn't mean leave much room on the table for a big IPO discount to make the deal work. There's also a heck of leverage in that business, which means that you're going to have to do a mainly primary IPO to get it across the line to reduce the leverage, which leaves a colossal overhang because everyone knows the sponsors are going to be wanting to sell out as soon as that lock-up expiry happens.
That's it.
And so the investors are going to be wanting an even bigger discount.
Yep.
So you've got a situation where you're going to price the thing at a potentially under what you bought it for. Then it could trade down.
And let's not forget, the IPO aftermarket performance has not been great.
No.
Either side of the pond, actually.
No, absolutely that. Worse in Europe at the moment, but that's only because the US has really been supported by two or three big deals that have worked from last year. But yeah, the IPO market performance in general has been pretty poor. I mean, to the extent where people are talking again about a broken European IPO market, which is what we've heard on and off since 2022. And by broken IPO, European IPO market, it seems to be the only way you can get an IPO done in Europe is to have it screamingly cheap compared to any peer, and then consistently hit every single number in your earnings. And if you don't do that, the IPO doesn't work. And that's really the issue that we're having in European new listings at the moment is you know, squaring the circles and getting these things done is once again seeming a bit of an impossibility.
And the issue I think we have as well is that this is a rally in the stock market. So not only would they require a huge discount because of that rally, but also the rally itself seems to me to be the lowest conviction rally of all time. It's like anyone you speak to will basically say it's mad, but you know, you've got to follow the flow.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have the head of the International Energy Agency, Fatih Birol, today, so we're recording this on the 23rd of April, saying that this is the greatest energy crisis of all time.
Yeah.
Lufthansa, it was revealed yesterday, I think, had cancelled 20,000 flights.
Yeah.
The fuel coverage of your average airline is like 48 hours rather than several weeks. I'm beginning to think that we'll start seeing this creeping into corporate earnings in the second quarter and third quarter. Mm-hmm. And if we start to actually see that that performance issue solidified, at that point, there could be the risk of a correction in European equities.
I think a huge correction potentially, and US as well. I think there's a real belief within the sort of banking community that we could be seeing a big retraction over the summer, particularly at times. And the summer is an awful time for equities.
Sell in May and go away. Exactly. That's what they always say, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and then liquidity is at sort of, you know, its lowest points through the summer months, particularly in Europe when everyone is away.
Yeah.
But even in the States, you know, liquidity does really drop over the summer months. Now, that leaves you open for very bad news to have massively outsized market effects. And I think to your point, John, despite the fact that it feels like this war with Iran between the US, Israel and Iran has been going on for quite a while, we're really only at the beginning of this when it comes to the economic impact.
By the way, even if there were a resolution today.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we're far from it at the moment. Yeah. I mean, as I say, on the day we're recording, the Straits of Hormuz are firmly shut. There is a US blockade, and Iran is also acting to shut itself. There's a shut the Straits itself by and targeting ships going through. So there does feel like there is no way to a resolution. So we're looking at a $100 oil plus now for the foreseeable future. Now, if you had said that to somebody at the beginning of the year, they would tell you that was an unmitigated disaster.
Yeah.
And so When we see that come through to earnings, to inflation, and by the way...
Well, you mentioned inflation. Yeah. Both the US and the UK recorded inflation at 3.3%.
Yeah.
I think France and is 2.8 in that kind of region. Mm. It's definitely already ticking up and fast.
Yes, yes, yes. And by the way, again, on the day we're recording this week, you know, if you looked at the predictions for Fed rate cuts from rate trade is often tracked by CME with a very, very good tool they have called FedWatch. People are not expecting a US rate cut until at least summer next year.
Yeah.
Now, that's a complete change in the expectation that we had at the start of 2026.
As an aside, that's actually quite good news for Fed independence.
Because
I think Jerome Powell would have been in a really on a sticky wicket if he felt that the market meant that he should cut rates. Mm. But people felt that he was being forced to do so.
Yeah, absolutely.
So at least they have good cover to hold rates while the kind of imbroglio. But back this side of the pond, if that inflation does bleed through and affect consumers and corporates alike, it undoes some of the things that we've been seeing in the market. So, for example, with the AI fallout that we had discussed just now and the way that it's impacted software players, there then was a lot of focus on the so-called halo stocks, asset, low obsolescence, and even some excitement around chemicals, for example, because there was this feeling that, there are cheap imports coming from China, but there's geopolitical dislocation. There needs to be European Union and UK support for the chemicals industry. I was speaking to one advisor who was saying that, you know, there might be some desire for resilience. There might be some desire to support the industry. But at the end of the day, the feedstock costs have gone up and the industry was already on its knees. So they're double effed. That feels like it's first order, but then it will go through to absolutely everything, whether it's manufacturing or consumer habits, et cetera, et cetera.
just to look at an anecdote, a deal like KNDS, right? You know, Franco-German right. defense business, probably the...
So this KNDS, yeah. right, should go absolute gangbusters. Yeah. And we had CSG, which, yeah. well, I think that's what you're coming to.
Yeah, perhaps. Well, it was, you know, best loved equity story that you could possibly have in, you know, in European equity at the start of the year, European rearmament, you know, even ESG-friendly stock now, yeah. which is sort of, you know, very odd dynamic,
yeah.
Given where we were a few years ago. But even KNDS now, which is a Franco-German defense contractor, one of the largest in Europe, sort of main peer would be Rheinmetall, which yeah. has obviously been the European darling of equities since really
tanks,
since the start
right?
of the war. Yeah, tanks. Yeah, tanks and guns. But with KNDS, the people are already asking questions about what their supply costs are going to be.
Right.
Because, you know, they have to transport these things, you yeah. know, across. They have to build all this stuff. Now, higher energy costs means that they are going to have a far different looking balance sheet than they perhaps were thinking they were going to have at the beginning of the year. How do you put that into IPO expectations? You know, the biggest thing that an IPO can do wrong, an IPO issuer, sorry, can do wrong, is missing numbers on the first set of earnings.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
yeah.
if you have multiple compression at the peer level, then at some point you're going to be need to try to get the money back some way as an issuer. Often they do that by being very aggressive on their earnings.
And Czechoslovak Group?
Well, again, missed earnings.
Right. And that listed earlier this year,
yep.
right?
Yeah.
And
Verisure, which Nordic listing last year, very, very good business, sort of a security systems business,
yeah.
Home security systems business. Again, disappointed on earnings.
Yeah.
And again, is below IPO price. So Europe's two largest listings since Porsche are now underwater. And that has an effect on the psychology of investors when they are looking at new IPOs, which is why they are wanting to pivot to large already listed situations because they can model it. And they know that these things have a track record over several earnings periods in time, and it is something where they have more liquidity and ability to, you know, shrink their position if they need to, and therefore they are far more comfortable investing money there. So they have capital to put to work, but they just do not want to put it to work in IPOs.
But with M&A and with IPOs, I think that there is still a lot of room for defensive names, truly defensive
yeah.
names.
Yeah.
to get ahead.
Small D, right?
Well, small and uppercase
yes,
D.
Yes, yes, yes.
But like, for example, we had the news break, I think earlier this week, that the Dieteren-owned Belgian giant Autoglass Replace
yeah.
owner, Balron,
yeah.
could list. That would be huge.
Yes, yes.
If you think about it, pretty bloody defensive, because at the end of the day, if a windscreen needs replacing, it needs replacing.
It needs replacing regardless.
How likely do you think it is that some of those more defensive names will still manage to transact between now and the end of the year? Or is this strange market dynamic just making everybody sit on the sidelines?
I think at the moment, I don't expect anything really big before summer. You know, I think unless we have a really significant change in the geopolitics. Now, we weren't likely to have a lot of IPOs before summer anyway. This was a very second half heavy year, but I don't see how you can put together an earnings prediction at the moment.
Mm.
I don't think, and one that satisfies the next quarter, let alone, you know, the next three or four when you're looking and putting and posting your forward earnings and putting those estimates together.
Mm.
Now, by the end of summer, if we have more clarity over sort of long-term oil being between 90 or 100 or 100 plus,
yeah.
you can probably make those estimates
yeah.
in that case. But I just don't think anyone is going to be willing to do that in a case where they think there may be a resolution at some point and oil go back down again. And that, I think, is the main issue.
And that, I think, is where there is a big difference with M&A.
Yeah.
Because I think M&A still, with the caveat that it's very bifurcated, as I said right at the top, you know, under the hood, particularly sponsor-held assets, there is quite a degree of pain
yeah.
and there isn't the aggregated deal count that you would expect to see with the headline numbers that we're accumulating in terms of the billions of 330 billion in the first quarter. You think that's up 38%. Happy days are here again. But actually, you know, a large number of large deals. We had like eight, I think, transactions of more than 10 billion in the first quarter.
Yeah.
We only had two in the first quarter of 25. There's a kind of heads I win, tails you lose dynamic
yeah.
with M&A.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because the larger players are thinking to themselves, okay, well, if the Iran crisis persists and you have this massive dislocation in geopolitical alliances, whether that's NATO in the US or the US and its trading relationship with other partners, then having that scale as a hedge really against that is absolutely necessary. If, on the other hand, there is a quick resolution and things get better quite quickly, then a lot of the larger corporates, many of them, of course, listed, their paper consideration is really quite valuable at
the
moment.
Absolutely, yeah.
So
yeah.
Basically, whichever way it goes, if you have the scale, there's an impulse to transact.
And as we said at the top of this podcast, the shareholders want to support you because they're not putting their money into IPOs.
Right.
So they're very happy to back big primary share raises to do accretive M&A, or what they can see as accretive M&A. And I don't think you actually have to have that much of an accretive story at the moment to convince.
That's right.
So I think this is the key. People have capital to put to work. And this is the optimistic case. There is capital to put to work. They are willing to, investors in equity are willing to put that to work in names they know in the secondary market, which allows sponsors and private equity with already listed assets to sell down. And they are very willing to commit it to M&A.
Yeah.
Now, what they are less likely to do at the moment, just given the performance of the asset class. And I said, with the European IPOs, it is mainly structural. You know, the outlook obviously doesn't help, and the geopolitics makes it particularly difficult. But what they don't want to do at the moment is take a risk on a very untested name that they has no history of public markets reporting, no history of public earnings before, because they are sitting on major losses. And therefore, it is not a risk they're willing to take without a colossal discount. And at this point, there's not many sellers who are going to want to do that at the moment.
Now, just moving on very, very quickly, because there's one other thing that I did want to touch on, which relates to the geopolitical side that we've been talking about. Something else that's coming down the track, which I think is very potentially very supportive for M&A, is the regulatory environment.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we talked about earlier, you know, there was some happiness at the beginning of the year in the chemicals sector that maybe regulation or protectionism would ride to the rescue through the on the white steed of resilience.
Yes.
The regulators and policymakers would use through the prism of resilience, they would seek to support certain key industries.
Yeah.
I think that it's not just about defensive industries and feedstocks and stuff like that. It's very clear that the European Union, for one, also wants to incentivize the scaling of innovative companies.
Yep.
Think about the likes of Lovable, the Vibe Coding app, Swedish, but incorporated Delaware. They don't want those companies incorporating and scaling in Delaware and sort of offshoring the profits US investors. They want more of that to happen in the EU. And part of that agenda is the new merger guidelines that have come from the European Commission. Some reports of tussles between Ursula von der Leyen as the European Commission president and the competition chief, Teresa Ribera. But what's interesting in the reporting that's been revealed by our Brussels team, Natalie McNellis and Tonno Gill, is that there is this new theory of benefit. So whereas in the past there would have been a theory of harm as to if these two entities were to combine, what damage would that do for innovation and scale and the opportunities for other players in the sector, they're introducing a theory of benefit that actually by bringing these two entities together, there'll be more consumer choice, there'll be more investment, there'll be more innovation, they will scale their R&D and therefore be able to make bigger improvements. This has a huge potential, I think, to drive deal sentiment.
Yes, I think so.
But at the same time, I'm slightly concerned that... So that's on the positive side of the ledger for policymakers. But on the downside, I'm looking both at the UK and across the European Union, and particularly Germany.
Yeah.
Their responses to the energy crisis have been dreadful.
Yeah.
And it's just another nail in the coffin that policymakers are not at the party in terms of what needs to be done to get investment flowing.
No, straight away. I mean, I'm to address both those points. Firstly, I think you're absolutely right on the regulatory attitude for M&A. I think, firstly, also, we can't look at Europe in a vacuum here. You know, if you see what all the talk is coming out of the UK government under Labour wanting to encourage growth through M&A.
Yes.
I mean, ever since the start of the second Trump administration, a competitive regulation towards M&A has basically been the byword. There is almost no sort of antitrust going on at the moment in the States. And, you know, our head of global regulation, Ruben Miller's, writes a wonderful column, Hell or High Water, where he often goes into this. Now, but so I think in general, I mean, would we call it a race to the bottom? Hopefully not. But I mean,
I think it's for very different reasons.
Yeah,
like
different
the
reasons.
EU and the UK want growth and innovation.
Yeah.
Whereas the US is a bit more of a Wild West scenario. But the net result is the same.
Yeah, absolutely.
There seems to be a greater accommodation for allowing bigger combinations than previously would have been the case.
No, absolutely. And so that's the environment that we're going in. And that absolutely goes to your point, John, to the flight to scale, because you can do that now. The regulators are not going to get in your way of creating these mega continental champions. And by continental with Europe, you know, perhaps you throw the UK in there as well. There does seem to be a rapprochement between you know, London and Brussels at the moment.
So, which the Iran crisis has seemed to accelerate.
Oh, absolutely. And it feels like, you know, Trump and Iran as sort of geopolitical drivers will do as much to reverse Brexit, I think, or in all but name, potentially. That certainly seems to be where what it looks like from at this stage. So I think we'll see greater alignment between the UK and EU on regulation. I think we'll see greater, you know, connectivity when it comes to industry. So I think we are looking at a continental European environment again, 100%. And I think that will filter potentially through to M&A.
But it doesn't help IPOs much.
No, it doesn't. Oh, yeah, maybe the dreams of a single European stock exchange is going to be helpful to IPOs. But no, at the moment, the IPO market remains a quandary, I think. And but on M&A, absolutely, I think the environment for M&A is fantastically healthy. I think the financing environment is very healthy, as long as you're not trying to do a load of debt. That's where I think. Yeah. And I think that's where, as you say, John, where it becomes more problematic for the mid-cap M&A. A lot of that will be dependent on leverage.
Yeah.
We're looking at it.
And it's already highly levered.
Exactly, already highly levered. Yeah. And we are now looking at an environment of higher interest rates for longer. Certainly, I think if anywhere they were going to rise, it would be in the European Union. I think, you know,
They start from a much lower base.
Far lower base.
Yeah.
I think the UK might just get away with holding rates, and we know the Fed will do everything it can possibly to hold rates. But I think certainly in the European Union, we're going to be looking at a higher rate environment and rising rates. If inflation ticks up far more than expected with the Iran crisis, I cannot see the BOE and the Fed holding off too much.
No.
If we have massive, rapid rising.
And the IMF has already trimmed its global growth forecasts, and there's probably more downside risk on that if the longer this extends.
Now, I mean, this brings again to the great debate over central banks and what they can do in an inflationary environment. Because once again, a little bit like the war in Ukraine, you know, this is not a demand, you know, fueled inflationary crisis. So will rate cuts do anything to stop inflation? That's probably the issue.
The standard playbook.
So rate rises, apologies.
No. But exactly. If you can see through the crisis, if you feel that there is a horizon, the best thing would be to look through it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's very difficult to know whether there is going to be that rise. Well, let's end on a positive note then, because large cap M&A is still going to go gangbusters, even if there's pain in the mid market.
With equity financing.
Though IPOs are not necessarily going to be the order of the day, financing a lot of those deals through equity capital markets issuance, secondaries, rights issues, etc., that's going to be very much in play, right?
And absolutely. And I guess one global point of positivity is the IPO story and the IPO quandary we keep talking about is a European phenomenon. We are seeing IPOs return in APAC. We are seeing IPOs return in the United States. We potentially have a $75 billion IPO in the United States this year in the form of SpaceX. So it's not as if the market globally is stopping, but there does need to be a bit of structural work in Europe to get investors back on board again and to win back the faith of investors from the banks and from the issuers. And I have to say, it is very much an issue for the sell side to fix.
And in the meantime, M&A going gangbusters.
It's all good for M&A.
Thank you very much, Sam.
Thanks, John.
That was John West, Merger Markets Global Commentary Editor, speaking to Sam Kerr, the head of global ECM at Merger Market. And just to point out, this episode was recorded on Thursday, the 23rd of April. Thank you for listening to Dealcast, the M&A podcast from Merger Market. To find out more about what's been discussed in this episode, have a look at our show notes. And do please give us a follow on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.